Okay, so I want to start with Isaiah 14, especially verses 12 down to about 15. And this is a passage that has great impact later on in Christian writers, church fathers, church doctors, as being not just about the king of Babylon, but really about the devil himself. This is a text for the fall of the devil and why the devil fell. I'd like to talk about that, but also I'd like to talk about the structure of this whole section, chapters 13, really over to about, well, let's say here, 23, where you have a series of prophecies, and in many translations, it will be translated as the burden of Babylon or the burden of the Philistines. In the Revised Standard, this word Masa, this Hebrew word Masa, is translated as oracle. So you're seeing that as oracle, oracle, oracle. But if you look at it in, for example, the Douay Rheims, you will see this word burden, the burden of Duma, the burden of the desert of the sea. And as I said last time, the idea of burden here is there are layers of meaning to it. First, that there is against all of these peoples and nations a burden of sin. That there is a kind of way, to use the example or use the language in the book of Daniel, you've been put into the balance and found wanting. You know, that there is the standard that you're supposed to be fulfilling that you're not. So that's a burden. But then also there is a corresponding retributive punishment. That too is the burden. This is the debt of pain or the debt of punishment that these various nations deserve. Even though they are in some way fulfilling God's will by afflicting the disobedient Israelites, they are still in their own way sinning because they are going against God's law in all sorts of ways. So, pardon me, let me get to that later. Let us start with 14, and again, let's just hear this section. Starting at verse 12. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit in the mount of the assembly in the far north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the depths of the pit. Okay. Now, in context, this is immediately about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is going to be exalted in an empire. He's going to conquer not only the Promised Land, but all sorts of other territories. He's the one who's going to haul off the Jews to Babylon. But he himself will be overthrown by the Medes and the Persians. He himself, or rather Balthazar, who is his descendant, the Babylonians are in turn going to be overthrown. So their empire will reach a height. They will exult in that height, but they will come to an end. They will get their comeuppance. And let's take this term day star. I have found with students that when we use this term day star, we talk about this when we read the Screwtape Letters, this term Lucifer. You know, what does this mean? And very few of the students know. This is describing Venus. When Venus rises in the morning, in other words, when it's because of Venus's orbit, it's always close to the sun. So you're either seeing it as a morning star rising before the sun, or you're seeing it as the evening star setting just after the sun. But remember, because its orbit is closer, you're, from our point of view, it always looks like it's with the sun. So when it rises in the morning before the sun, it's called the light bearer. That's what literally Lucifer means, the bearer of the light. Because it's heralding, it's coming before, as it were, almost announcing the sunrise. When you see it in the evening, the Romans called it Vespers. They called it the evening star. Okay, they knew that it was the same, you know, the same planet, but they named it differently depending on when it appeared. So when you are using the term day star, you're announcing something as bright, as glorious, as associated with some kind of building action, you know, like the sunrise. So when you refer to a political leader as a day star, that this is something that is leading up to a glorious reign, glorious and clear and bright and brilliant for all to see. Okay? And there are going to be all sorts of reasons why that then will transfer over to the devil. William Kay, who's one of the Anglican commentators on Scripture, points out that when you look at, if you like, the burden of Babylon, like what's going to happen to Babylon, he writes that Babylon did not at once disappear after it was hurled from its imperial throne, but it suffered a gradual decay. Okay, so you have to bear in mind here that even though the Babylon Empire declines in power, it doesn't quite look the way it's described at the end of 13. In other words, it isn't just like this is just turned into a wasteland overnight. But what does happen over time is gradually, bit by bit, Babylon becomes less and less important as a city. That it had this kind of glorious height, and over the centuries it becomes a minor place, and finally it really is fulfilled. What is talked about at the end of 13, that it's a wilderness. Nomads go there. So that when you read someone like Josephus, by the time of Josephus, he's writing about Babylon as an abandoned city. He's writing about it as a place that is not just an echo of its former greatness. It's like the likeness that I gave you last time, like these post-apocalyptic movies where the vines are growing up the walls. Okay. Very early on in Christian writing, people see this description of the fall of the Babylonian king, this inflation of pride, and then the fall. They see that as a kind of image of the devil. So, for example, you would see it in Origen, who's writing in around 200 AD. And you also see it in, for example, in Augustine, who's writing about 100 years later. And, in fact, if you one of the things that I did in the Google Doc, I put the text from Augustine. This is from On Christian Doctrine. This is a little book that he wrote on kind of how to interpret Scripture. And he talks, when he comes to this passage, he'll say, what is said in Isaiah? How is he fallen from heaven, Lucifer, the son of the morning? And other statements of the context of which, under the figure of the king of Babylon, are made about the same person, are, of course, to be understood of the devil. And yet the statement which is made in the same place, he is ground down to the earth who sends out all the nations, does not fitly apply to the devil himself. For although the devil sends his angels to all nations, yet it is his body, not himself, that is ground down on each, except that he himself is in his body, which is beaten small like the dust. Okay? So in other words, the power of the devil is eventually what's destroyed in the world, not the devil himself. Okay? So very early on, church fathers see in this language of Lucifer, you know, that's how we get Lucifer as a name for the devil. You know, from this passage. Now, if you're a Hebrew commentator, you're not going to see a devil in this. You're probably going to think more along the lines of Nebuchadnezzar or Balthazar or another king. Because remember, in the Old Testament, revelation about the devil is pretty few and far between. And that might be a helpful point to remember. There are things which we have clarity about in the New Testament, which when you look in the Old Testament, aren't distinct. At the beginning in Genesis, where you have the serpent tempting Adam and Eve, you know, that's the devil is something that is revealed later. It's in the Book of Wisdom that you're told by the envy of the devil, sin entered the world. What you've got is this talking serpent. What you've got is something that's clearly odd and supernatural in some way, or at least unnatural, but you don't distinctly have a devil. The first place in the Old Testament where you get the devil introduced in his own proper person is the book of Job. And you have to remember, the book of Job is a very strange book. It begins with God and the devil like having conversations. You know, like the devil stops by, you know, ask God how things are going. God asks, where have you been? God asks. Like he stops by and, you know, checks in periodically. Roaming round about the earth, right? To and fro is what the devil responds. And God, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in all the earth? Okay? In that very strange book, this is where in the Old Testament you first meet the devil. So there are various devils that you meet along the way. If you think about the book of Tobias, where there's this devil Asmodeus that is killing the husbands of Sarah. And there's certainly, it sounds like Baal and Moloch at times are almost devils. But a distinct knowledge of the devil as this enemy intelligence that's working with other enemy intelligences and targeting the human race, that is not clearly in the Old Testament. That is not something that is spelled out, laid out in the way that it is that, think very early on in the Gospels, Matthew 4, where Jesus goes out to the desert to be tempted, and there's the devil tempting him. You are getting a kind of clarity about that in the New Testament that you don't have in the Old. Now, if you're wondering why are we being told this in such a veiled way? In fact, think about how the New Testament really just unveils completely the situation of the world. You don't have demonic possession in the Old Testament. Does that mean there wasn't demonic possession? You don't have diabolic temptation as explicitly. You have this conversation between Job it's a conversation between God and the devil. But you don't have Job having some conversation with the devil, right? Does that mean that there aren't diabolic temptations happening? You are not being told fully of the power of the devil in the Old Testament, because if you had that without the knowledge of Jesus Christ and salvation, you would despair. You would despair. You are given a fuller knowledge of those things at a time that the remedy appears. You are given a fuller knowledge when Jesus Christ not only exercises power over devils, but delegates that power to his apostles, that his apostles are going to do this too. It's one of the interesting things in movies, for all of the you know, Hollywood schlock aspects of it, the Exorcist really does have a confrontation between a real evil and priests who are exercising real authority. So one of the things that, you know, if you can kind of get through a very disturbing movie, you know, people remember these priests chanting together, "The power of Christ compels you." You know, people tend to remember that. One of the things that's happened in horror movies since that is there aren't priests chanting together, "The power of Christ compels you." One of the very disturbing things in contemporary horror movies is the demonic always wins, because there isn't something to match the demonic. People no longer, or at least in cinematic depiction, they no longer have belief in a kind of all-powerful goodness which is able to stand up to the demonic. Unless you have something of God to stand up against the demonic, you will lose. You will lose. By the way, you even see it in these cheesy 1950s Hammer vampire films, Christopher Lee and all that. If you're going to act against the vampire, you go get a Catholic priest. Right? No offense to Lutherans, but you don't get the Lutheran pastor against the vampire. No offense to Methodists, you don't get the Methodist minister. Right? The Catholic priest is this obligatory presence in a vampire movie. As if you're really taking on some kind of supernatural evil, those guys seem to know more about that stuff. Okay? So We are given rather limited knowledge about the devil in the Old Testament, but that's why you have to have that power and consolation that comes through Jesus Christ to be able to bear that knowledge. Otherwise, it's unbearable. Okay, so note these key points in the text which later commentators, the church fathers, the church doctors will laser in on. Verse 13, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will set my throne on high. I will ascend to the heights of the clouds. You know, commentators look at that and they talk about how it is that this helps you to understand what is the source of the rebellion of the devil. The source of that rebellion is pride. Pride is the principal sin of the devil. And by pride, we don't mean like being proud of your country or proud of your school or proud of your parents. The idea of pride here is that you have excessive self-love. Okay, excessive self-love. Excessive desire for your own good. A desire for your good, kind of in contempt of the good of others, or in fact, even to the detriment of others' good. So last time, if you recall, I talked about some of the capital sins, greed and gluttony and so on. All of those vices are rooted in pride. When you talk about greed or gluttony, lust, envy, that those are capital sins. Pride is not described as a capital sin because it's the root of them all. So that when you are lustful or gluttonous or greedy, all of those things involve some excessive self-love in some area. Okay? One of the things with the sophomores in the fourth quarter, so right after spring break, that's when we start reading the Screwtape letters. And I do either right before spring break or right when we come back, I do this little week-long thing called Angelology 101, right? Kind of an introduction to what angels are like and therefore what devils are like. And I always have some number of students like, how can you really know this? Because they've been formed in that scientific outlook that if you can't experiment on it, you know, test it, capture an angel and boil it down to its elements, you don't really have knowledge. And I have to point out to them, well, look, you got a mind and you got a will, and those are not things that you know experimentally. Those are things that you know by reflection. And if you got a mind and got a will, there are just certain things that are true about a being that has those things. So if all you are is spirit, all you are is mind and will, you're not going to be a glutton. You're not going to have a body with excessive, you know, desires for food, even angel food cake or devil food cake, right? You're not going to be greedy. If you're a spirit, what are you going to do with money? You know, there are just certain things you can eliminate. But the most basic vice of a rational being is that because it's able to know and because it's able to choose and because it's able to love, as a rational being, you should be able to love these wonderful goods that are outside you. But of course, as a rational being, because you're able to reflect and know and love, you are able to turn that inward. In other words, you are able to love yourself and love yourself too much. Okay, and that's what's at the root of pride. Okay? That's what's at the root of pride. There's a consideration of St. Thomas, and I also put this in the Google Doc, so you can read it in the original if you want, where he will say, like, how did the devil sin? Did the devil sin by desiring to be like God? And there's a way in which that's true, and there's a way in which, of course, it couldn't be true. Lucifer is certainly much smarter than any of us are, so he's not going to think, I can become God. You know, like the way that you're lower in the company, I can become manager. Or you're one of the vice presidents, I could become the CEO. Right? He knows that he can't become an all-powerful, eternal being. The devil knows that he's created. He knows that he's a created spirit. He doesn't think that he can somehow become what God is. Okay, so in that way, no, he doesn't aspire to be like God. But the way in which St. Thomas points out that he could aspire to be like God is to desire something from himself that he could only have from God. In other words, to desire a good or desire a happiness or desire a self-sufficiency that, in fact, only God could give. And to some degree, you know, all of us can desire that too. When you think about Adam and Eve in the garden, when they sinned in a kind of disordered love of the divine likeness. You will be as gods, knowing both good and evil. And what that meant was, you will be the measure for yourself of good and evil. You will be able, if you like, to put it in modern terms, you will be able to create your own values. You will be able to establish your own goods. You will be able to, you know, set your own priorities. As if there wasn't some kind of more fundamental good, more fundamental priority, more fundamental fulfillment of their happiness that, in fact, they couldn't provide for each other or for themselves. So what the devil rebelled against, you know, putting it almost kind of more big picture now, the devil rebelled against the whole order of grace. Okay, remember that there are things that are true by nature. There's an order there of nature, but then there's an order of grace. When you talk about an order of nature, there are plants, there are animals, there's us, there's angels, and way up at the top, beyond all these creatures, is God. Okay, so angels are higher than we are because they're pure spirits. By pure, I don't mean, you know, chastity. I mean, they are pure. They are free from matter and any limitations of matter. They are pure minds. They are pure wills. And let's say Lucifer was from the highest order. This is the best and most brilliant and most beautiful of all the angels. Okay, according to the natural order, maybe he's like right below God. He's like right at the top. Okay, that's the order of nature. But then there's the order of grace. In other words, there's the order of what God gives to his creatures above and beyond the order of nature. So there are things that we can naturally know about God. There are natural ways that we're able to love God and move to God. But according to the order of grace, we are having a love put into us above and beyond our natural abilities. We are being now able to know God as he is, pardon me, as he is in himself. Pardon me, we're able to know God as he is in himself, that we're able to know him as Father, Son, Holy Spirit. We're not just knowing him as a first mover or as a cause in nature or as a supernatural mind. We are able, through revelation, to know the inner life of the Trinity. That we're able to know him as Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and therefore that we're able to love God as he is in himself. That is an elevation of the mind. That's an elevation of the heart. That is a gift of God. That isn't nature. Well, notice that what happens is once you start introducing gifts of grace, that completely changes the order of nature. Because now you can have people who would have been lower, who are now higher, and people who are higher, who are now lower. Okay? I think it's St. Thomas, I'm not going to be able to quote this exactly, but he talks about how it is that, he's commenting on the creed, and he says, the simple woman who is saying, the simple old educated, uneducated woman who's reciting her prayers and reciting the creed, she knows more about God than Aristotle. She knows more about God than the wisest of philosophers. She doesn't know it by her natural ability. She knows it because she has made an ascent of faith and of hope. She's opened her heart to charity, and now God has given these things to her. So in the order of nature, maybe, you know, a philosopher like Aristotle is, you know, intellectually up here, and she's down here. But because of the order of grace, right, she's now up here. And he's down there because she knows about the inner life of God and he couldn't even begin to guess at the inner life of God. Okay? Now, think about how this impacts the angels. If there's an order of nature, and just an order of nature, let us say that Lucifer, the light bearer, he's up here. All of us human beings are down here. But if there's an order of grace that the divine nature would in fact join itself to human nature, that it would join itself through a young woman in Palestine, that young woman would now be referred to by titles like the Mother of God, the Queen of the Angels, right? The Queen of Creation. That means that she's now up here, and Lucifer could very well be down here. Okay? So things change once you have an order of grace, once you move from an order of nature to an order of grace. Evidently, some number of angels were open and willing to enter into this new order, and those are the spirits that we call angels. Right? Those are the spirits we call angels. They're not just naturally knowing God or naturally able to know about God. They are glorified. They are receiving a full vision of who God is. But then there are some number of spirits who did not want the order of nature subverted. They didn't want it changed. They enjoyed their preeminence. And they said, no. No. I will not serve. That's the language in Jeremiah, in the prophet Jeremiah, chapter 2. I will not serve. I will not submit myself to this new order. So that's why it is sometimes you will hear, as a kind of probable theological opinion, that why did the devil fall? He fell because of the incarnation. He fell because he would have to, as it were, submit himself to creatures that were lower than himself. He would have to submit himself to creatures that are lower than himself. And that's something that follows more generally from objecting to the order of grace. No, I want the natural hierarchy where angels are at the top and, you know, the human beings are lower than us, and I don't want any moving around. I don't want any shifting. We should be able to preserve the greatness that we enjoy. But once God starts bestowing his gifts, he subverts those things. In Scripture, in the Old Testament, the way you see it over and over again, remember, if you're the eldest child, you're supposed to get the honor. You're supposed to get the blessings. And think of how many times in the Old Testament the younger one or the youngest one is the one that triumphs. So Jacob and Esau. Remember, the very name Jacob means supplanter. Supplanter, putting himself in the way. That's how Esau describes him, especially after he gets his blessing stolen. He's named the supplanter, and supplanter he is. He has taken my birthright. Okay? But that's an image. We remember it vividly with Jacob and Esau. That's an image throughout. Think about, we were talking about this just a couple of weeks ago, the anointing of David. When Jesse starts putting his boys out to have them, you know, is this the possible next king? He doesn't even think to bring in David. Samuel has to press him. Are you sure you don't have any other sons? And Jesse is, well, I mean, I've got David, but, you know, sort of like, why him? And that's the very one that Samuel recognizes and anoints. That is not, if you like, the order of nature. The order of nature is the eldest is best. If you haven't heard this term or heard it in a while, primogeniture, the privilege of being the firstborn. Okay? And over and over again in the Old Testament, that gets subverted. Well, that, in a way, in a cosmic scale, is what happens to Lucifer. He expects an order of nature and to be able to remain in that order of nature. And like Esau, he gets supplanted. He gets supplanted by a Jewish girl who then becomes the queen of the angels, who then becomes the queen of the universe. That is intolerable. Okay? And it's the kind of thing that seems to be confirmed in this imagery in the book of Revelation. When there's this woman who's giving birth, and the dragon wants to devour her child. Now, there are ways in which that woman is representative of the church. But it's also hard not to see that this woman who's laboring that delivers a child that wants to be devoured, it's hard not to see that the way that Jesus is born in Bethlehem and Herod strives to kill him. So it's hard not to see Our Lady in that imagery as well. So just as Babylon has this very gradual decline, it takes a long time for Babylon to fall. There's a way in which once Christ enters into the world, there's this gradual decline of the devil's power. And it may not look gradual, but again, you have to compare it to what did the world look like in, you know, before Christianity. It's the kind of thing that the conquistadors, remember, the conquistadors are for all practical purposes, pirates. I mean, they're pirates. They're soldiers of fortune. They're buccaneers. But when they come and they see the Aztecs and see the Aztecs sacrificing on this colossal scale, it awed even them. And they see something that they can't help but think of as demonic. This is demonic. That you would behead people, that you would pull the hearts out of living people and hold it aloft and behead them and throw their bodies and their heads down the steps and do this where you're killing thousands of people, tens of thousands of people. And then remember, there was a thing the history teacher showed me, because this was on National Geographic. They remember, there was, for a while, people thought that the conquistadors really exaggerated the extent to which this was happening. In other words, they're just creating bad PR for the Aztecs to make themselves look good. And I want to say in the last 5-10 years, they're doing these excavations near Mexico City, and they get this underground chamber where it's, imagine like a little stepped, kind of like a little stepped pyramid, but what they have is racks of skulls, and they're on long rods, long wooden rods, because what they would do is they would take the heads, they'd remove all the flesh, they would drill holes in the sides, and then they would put all these skulls all together on these racks, and then you put them on these kind of little step things, rack after rack after rack after rack after rack after rack. And so if anything, it doesn't just look like conquistadors weren't exaggerating. It's like they didn't tell the half of it. It was even worse than their descriptions. But I give that as an example of how it is that things can look before the power of the gospel came. That you really had things that just simply looked outright demonic. And there can be all sorts of things that are very bad now in the world. There can be all sorts of things that are very, very bad in our own country. But you need to be able to appreciate how it is over 2,000 years of Christianity that there were a lot of important changes in terms of how society lived, a sort of affirmation of human dignity, an aspiration to higher moral and spiritual goods than existed before Christ came. So you have to remember that in terms of the power of the devil. You can look out at the world, you can look out in the country, and it just, well, my father would always say, the world always looks like it's left in the custody of a pack of trolls. And especially, I think if you were, this was, I think, always my father's problem. He was born in 1935, and so by the time he was a teenager, you know, the World War II was over, and he was starting that prosperity, that 1950s prosperity. And there was just this, you know, unprecedented period during the 30s, 40s, 50s, and the early 60s when American cities were clean and safe and livable. You just sort of took that for granted. And so if you grew up in that era, it's like you lived through the Great Depression, and you lived through the Second World War, and then suddenly life really became wonderful. And then in the late 60s and 70s, it just came to a screeching halt. And, you know, San Francisco of the 1970s and 1980s was not the San Francisco of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And you could take almost any city like that. New York City, you know, the 30s, 40s, and 50s. A place like Harlem, remember, was a working class neighborhood of intact families. It was not a ghetto. It was not full of gang violence. The other example I like to use, if you grew up in watching cartoons in the 70s and you watched Bill Cosby, Fat Albert, remember those are Bill Cosby's recollections about growing up in inner city Philadelphia. So they aren't stories about gangs and drugs, not just because it was children's television. That's because West Philadelphia didn't look like that. Again, it was like Harlem. They were sort of intact families. I give those sort of examples because as things, when things get worse, you just think that the devil has the upper hand, or he's just getting the upper hand. But you have to remember that big picture. There are still a lot of things about modern life going back now hundreds of years, which are just significantly better than they were in these pre-Christian and pagan days. I will say this, though. As there is a more conscious rejection of Christianity, as there's a more conscious rejection of religion, yeah, then it does start to look really bad. Then it does start to look like, I think of this very sad line from Pope John Paul II's Gospel of Life encyclical, where he was writing about the declining respect of human life. When he addresses abortion and infanticide, he says, we are with the proposals not just to take unborn human life, but to even kill babies after they are born. We are reverting to a state of barbarism that one thought we had left behind forever. That's the language of Pope John Paul. We revert to an era of barbarism that we thought we had left behind forever. What do you want to ask, Barbara? So, the birth control pill in its trials was 1960, 1961, and then it's marketed in 1965, and it's shortly after that Griswold versus Connecticut, that 1968, that's the Supreme Court decision that overturns the last remaining state regulations against contraception. Because as strange as it sounds, remember, up to the 1930s, artificial contraception was illegal in the United States. At that point, remember early on, you're talking about condoms.
It wasn't even developed until the early
60s? No, up through the 60s, people were still using barrier methods. I remember asking my father, there were condoms around. Why didn't that create a sexual revolution? And my father said, well, barrier methods always had a kind of a yuck factor to them. Whereas the pill made it private, relatively easy, that was something that fundamentally changed human behavior. Remember when the birth control pill was first marketed, it wasn't marketed as a birth control pill because there were a lot of places where that was regulated by law that was forbidden. So you advertised it as regulating female cycles. This will help your cycles get regular. Warning, this medication will make you infertile. So there were a lot of women who said, hey, wait a minute. And all of a sudden they had irregular cycles. And then after Griswold versus Connecticut, you don't even need to go through the pretense. Now, that's worth raising because, of course, the birth control pill, abortion, by themselves, they're bad. But they're part of a bigger thing, which we usually describe as the sexual revolution. And that's the more fundamental thing. Because once you, that is so fundamental to human life that once people are confused about that, there's no end of confusion. There's a very insightful book, Wilhelm Reich. This is the one who did the mass psychology of how is it described again? He was a Marxist. I think it's called The Mass Psychology of Fascism. I'm trying to remember the title of the book. But anyway, he was the one who had the theory that psychologically people have, as it were, a kind of psychic energy which can be channeled into things that were physical, like sexual activity, and then spiritual energy. And what you wanted to do, if you were going to radicalize people, if you were going to bring them to communism, which is where he wanted to bring them, the problem with Catholics is they regulate their sexual energy by their spiritual energy. So what you have to do is sexually corrupt them, because that's what's going to allow you to bring them over, to something like communism or socialism. So in other words, you can't attack Catholics directly in terms of what they believe, but once you corrupt them sexually, then they'll rechannel that spiritual energy in a communist or socialist direction. And to me, it's one of the things that's particularly disturbing about college campuses and college life. People think of the left-wing politics, that's in a box, and they think of the sexual decadence and the sexual experimentation, and they put that in a box. And when you read someone like Wilhelm Reich, you realize, no, these are things that go together. They go together. They're fundamentally related to each other. They feed into each other. I mean, the simplest, if this sounds all highfalutin, look, if you are somebody who's been raised that you know that you should be chaste, you know that you should be sexually controlled, and now you're living in a kind of a sexually permissive or sexually decadent way, you need to kind of recover your sense of self-worth and your moral sense. So that's what socialism and communism do. I care for the poor. I despise the greedy rich. I want to work for a better world. So the drafts on your sense of moral inadequacy over here in the sexual misbehavior part are paid for by your concern for the world, the future, the poor, over here in this part. And in fact, I remember meetings that I would have when I was the Justice and Peace Director in La Crosse, where I would have, in fact, people explicitly tell me, don't nag me about that sexual misbehavior stuff or birth control pills, or don't nag me about that. I'm caring about the things that are real, like digging wells in Africa or addressing minimum wage, or, in other words, those things buy me. They're my ticket out of having to follow traditional sexual morality. But Wilhelm Reich, I think that's a very insightful thing, that if there is not control of those sort of fundamentals, things that are at the root of human desire to love and be loved and so on, if those things are corrupted, then it ends up corrupting our love for God and our love for His law. Because loving, if you love me, keep my commandments. Those things are clearly related in the gospel as well. It isn't just all you like the Beatles, all you need is love. There's a little more to it than that. Okay, well, I didn't I wanted to talk more about the burdens, but so I will talk about that next time. Remember that next week, November 4th, is parent teacher conferences, so we won't be meeting. I guess I will be at my desk on a Google Meet, meeting parents sequentially in a Google Meet. And so therefore the questions for the next there, but it's a combined reading 2 weeks from now. If you go into the Google Doc, you'll see I put them in this morning. Questions for understanding, questions for application, they're there for those two readings. And that is that. Very good. We will continue to see you in 2 weeks. Thank you. I'm sorry? Wilhelm Reich. R-E-I-C-H. Wilhelm, like around 1950s. Yeah, 40, 30s, 40s, 50s, right in that era.
Obviously German.
Obviously. And somebody who fled Germany because he was an opponent of fascism. Okay, that's good. But he was an opponent of fascism because he was a Marxist.
Okay, spelling of that again?